Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira. And yeah, we're getting kicked out.
Definitely for this one.
So, hi, everybody. I hope you're feeling great. This week, we will be jumping back into our Sex in the Bible series. We had a previous discussion on queer theology, and this week we're talking about polyamory and non-monogamy. The acknowledgement here is that we know that monogamous relationships were not the only thing jamming in the Bible, and we just want to examine that and examine the implications of that. So this week we were joined by a guest, Evian Whitney.
Yeah, so the goal of this series is to take a look at the different ways that sex is presented in the Bible. And not necessarily juxtapose that with the way it's presented now, but it's these ways that we're talking about are not what's normally put forth.
Exactly.
And in some cases, especially in this case, you'll see it's a significant part of specifically the Old Testament. So, Evian Whitney came and joined us. She does sexual liberation work. She has a podcast, The Sexually Liberated Woman, which is a great show for anyone wanting to check her out. We tried to get all three of us on. Didn't quite work out the way
we wanted.
But we were still able to get a good interview and spoke for a while with Evian, and she was able to share some of her experience with us. And so we wanted to share with you. So we hope that you enjoy this interview.
Yes.
This is going to be a fun one, y'all.
Yep. Out the church we go.
Today, I am not quite flying solo, but Amira couldn't make it today. And so I am here with a very special guest as we continue our Sex in the Bible series. I am joined by Evian Whitney. Welcome to the show.
Yay. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate this. I think we're going to have a great conversation, hopefully, about something very important.
Yeah, I think so, too.
For those who don't know, Evian Whitney is a writer, sensualist, and sexuality doula. She helps facilitate, educate, and hold space for women and femme-identifying folks who desire to come into the full, unashamed expression of their erotic selves. When she's not writing about sex or teaching people how to take sensual selfies as a method of sexual liberation, she's helping women and femmes step out of sexual shame and into their erotic power via one-on-one coaching and intimacy counseling. You can find more about her work at sexloveliberation.com and see her brazenly celebrating her sexuality on Instagram at Evian, that's E-V-Y-A-N dot Whitney. And she's here today to help guide us through one of the topics that we never get to talk about in church. I don't know. I can figure out why. But why don't you tell us and the listeners a little bit about how you got started doing this work?
Yeah, I really appreciate that you started off by saying that this is a topic that never gets talked about in church, because I was born into a pretty strict Christian home. And while I did have some understandings that back in the day, like way back in the day, there were practices of polygamy in the Bible, the way that it was expressed to me was that, you know, that wasn't the best method of doing things. Like, that was before they didn't know any better. And then eventually they sort of grew out of that and realized that it's, you know, marriage is between one man and one woman. In terms of how I got started with this work, I mean, it was, I always tell people that this work kind of chose me, because just based on where I was at in my life, I mean, the trajectory of my work, it was not going to be in this realm. I mean, I started off living my life in a completely different way. And the reason why I initially got into this work is because I had just a lot of sexual shame in my own relationship. And that really kind of started to show itself even more when I got married. And so as a way to figure all of that stuff out, as a way to make sense of my own sexual shame, my sexual trauma, and also my sexual orientation and the different ways that I wanted to be in relationship with my husband, I started writing about my sex life. And that kind of brought me to where I am today, where not only am I writing, I'm also... I've always been a writer. I've always been someone who has processed herself and her weird things through writing. And so it was through writing that I began to process my sexual shame, my sexual trauma. And from there, you know, after I started very publicly writing about my sexual dysfunction and the issues that were coming up in my marriage, a lot of people were asking me like, so what would it be like, you know, can we go to a workshop of yours? Can we buy a book? Can I work with you? And I was looking at these people like they were crazy because I was like, there's no way. Like, I don't know what I'm doing most of the time. But after a few years of people continually bugging me about it, I finally decided to just try it, start doing sessions with people, helping them in the same way that I helped and healed myself around sex and sexuality. And I mean, the rest is history. I've been doing this for almost 8 years now.
Well, I think that makes sense. I mean, a lot of people, for whatever reasons, whether it's religious upbringing, sexual shame, shyness, they just don't talk about sex. And if they do, they definitely don't do it out loud, like on a website where they're blogging about it and they're talking about their own experiences. So seeing someone who is, that's a first sign of liberation to someone else who is not at that point where they can say, well, I would like to be that open, or she's that open, and she's maybe at least further along than I am. And so that does make sense that people would ask for help.
Yeah.
Okay. So I do need to start off this conversation for our listeners. We are talking non-monogamy. Some cases we may say polyamory or something like that, but this is not to be confused with infidelity. It's not the same thing. So we're talking about consensual relationships where both parties are aware. And this is not intended to, I don't want anyone going back and say, well, Faith Uncut said that I could do after you got caught. You know, that's not what this is.
Yes.
This is, we're going to talk about how it's represented in the Bible, and then also how consensual non-monogamous relationships work in real life. And we'll draw on some of Evian's experience. Okay, so just to jump into the Bible for a second. In the beginning, okay, there are two main issues addressed by all cultures. So the Bible comes out of the tradition of Judaism, and there are other people at this time. All of those people have their own creation myths and stories, and they're all sharing some of the same challenges. Two of the major challenges that people were having were agricultural challenges and also procreation challenges. They did not have the technology that we have available to us today. And so these were things that in some ways, agriculture, fertility were out of their control. And these two aspects or elements are central to most ancient myths and creation stories. So in the Bible, when you see God punishing Adam and Eve, Adam is cursed with working the land and the land not producing, and Eve is cursed with pain and childbearing. And so what we're seeing, the combination of those two are fertility challenges, one being fertility of the land, the other being fertility of the womb. And because the Bible is not written in real time, meaning no one's running behind people recording each event, this is written after some life or time has passed. And so people are trying to explain some of these very real challenges that they're living through. And because this is so common, this becomes part of the creation myth. Because there are fertility challenges, specifically in childbearing, where there's a lot of mothers die during childbirth and or are unable to conceive, it happened to be common for men to have many partners. And the culture kind of dictated they had as many as they could support. And that ensured the best chance of having children and more children. And this goes into promises to Abraham and things like that, that you have many, you know, many nations will come from you and things like that. But that leads to an interesting dynamic in the Old Testament where we don't really pay attention to it a lot in church, but pretty much every relationship that you see in the Old Testament is a relationship with multiple persons. And we don't call them polyamorous relationships because women are seen as property of the fathers, and then the fathers marry them off to the husbands. And so they don't necessarily have a choice in that. And we also don't call them polyamorous because these are not relationships built on love. They are economic unions. These are families being paid and kind of increasing their economic position. And so this is something that is throughout the entire Old Testament and into the New Testament. And it's important for us to, as we're going through the Sex in the Bible series, just to look at the different ways that the Bible does view sex. So in the Old Testament, every person except for, I believe, Isaac is the only monogamous person in the entire Testament and then the whole covenant. Everyone else seems to have multiple partners. The only man that is monogamous. Monogamy is not part of the Levitical code. And you got rules around shrimp. You have rules around cleanliness. You have rules for everything. There's chapters and chapters of rules. Monogamy is not in there. In fact, the Torah kind of assumes in Deuteronomy 21, verse 15, that multiple partners are a normal thing in the way it addresses it. And then you go into the New Testament and you have some of the commands of Paul. I don't know. I'm not sure about your background. You said you grew up in a, you grew up around church a little bit, right?
Yeah. I was born, raised in a Christian household. So I'm very familiar with the Bible. I'm very familiar with, I certainly couldn't, you know, speak certain scriptures. I have since connected myself from the church, but I definitely understand, certain facets of it because I was raised within it.
Yeah. So I'm sure you may have heard some of the scriptures in the New Testament around Paul and, you know, wives and how people are conduct themselves in marriage. And here's my issue with Christians who kind of follow Paul. So in the New Testament, there's many preachers basically going around spreading the gospel. You have Paul, you have Peter, you have Barnabas, there's lots of people and they all have different takes on it. And Paul has a take and that take is what a lot of people draw their doctrine from. But Paul is like, let's say, Evian, let's say you and your husband were having just terrible problems in your marriage. You couldn't figure it out. You're always arguing. This is not healthy. You're thinking about calling it quits.
Yeah.
All right. So he says, all right, well, before we do that, let's go at least talk to somebody, see if we can get some help. Okay. Mm-hmm. But the person that you go talk to is someone who's never been married, doesn't understand this, doesn't want to be married. That's probably not the best person to talk to when you're trying to get marital advice. That's
right.
Paul.
Yeah.
Paul has never done this and he's acknowledged that he's not doing this. And he even tells people as he's writing this, these are not God's words. These are my words. And so Paul is the guy that gives you the bad financial advice and he's broke and he's trying to tell you how to manage your money. That's what he's doing with marriages. And so that's why when I'm reading the New Testament, I'm like, well, Paul, we're going to take your words with a grain of salt here. There's a lot of quotes in the New Testament referencing Genesis 2:24, which is the main scripture that comes up where it says, a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife. And that's kind of the only main scripture about marriage. A lot of it is about divorce. And then you have in 1 Timothy 3, where it says deacons and overseers, they are the husband of one wife, which begs the question, okay, what about everyone else? So it's presented in one way in church and we typically ignore this large body of evidence that suggests that non-monogamy is also a real thing. Okay. Mm. So how do we go from a biblical framework to where we are now, where monogamy is so prized? And the way this happens, and I'll do this quickly because I really want to get to your story, because I think it's just
I mean, this is fascinating. I'm learning stuff right now, so this is great.
So Paul is spreading, and the rest of the apostles are spreading Christianity during a time when Rome is in power, and so Paul is sneaking basically this message of Jesus and what Jesus did. And he's going into these Roman occupied areas, is going close to Rome and spreading this out amongst house churches and things like that. But Rome is the power. Now, in Rome, in Roman culture during this time, they were moving towards monogamy, but not because it was a moral imperative. It was because they are increasing the sizes of their armies and they saw those unions as effective ways to build armies. And so this became the norm in the cultures that the Bible now is spreading, or not the Bible, but the this news about Christ and because the Bible hadn't been written yet, but this news about Christ is spreading in this environment where monogamy is becoming popular because of the occupation of Rome and how they chose to build their empire. All right. So Christians adopted the practice of monogamy and this began to spread more. But this is how we get from cultures where it really wasn't a big deal to the point where it wasn't in the code that God gave to the Israelites. And now we're in this space where monogamy is the thing. So that's how we historically got there. Monogamy reigned supreme for a long time. I mean, you know, there were pockets of non-monogamous relationships and things like that. But now we're starting to see kind of a resurgence in non-monogamous relationships. Mm-hmm. And so for those who may not know, can you define that for us? What is non-monogamy?
So non-monogamy is actually a term that is a kind of umbrella word for people who are practicing open relationships, whatever that looks like. So non-monogamy can look like I am married and I have a girlfriend and that girlfriend is not included within my marriage. The relationship that I have with her is separate from the relationship that I have with my husband. Now, monogamy can also look like my husband has multiple partners in a sexual realm. He doesn't have a romantic connection with them. They're just sexual partners. And he also has a relationship with me, his wife. There are many, many different iterations of non-monogamy. Many people choose non-monogamous kind of lifestyles and practices because it's a really great way to get needs met that you're not able to get met within the current relationship that you're in. And so like one great example is that like I'm a queer woman and I love my husband dearly. We've been together for almost 12 years, but there's no way in hell that I'm going to be able to get what I need from him if I'm talking and thinking about my queer identity. And so non-monogamy is a way for people to explore and express parts of themselves sexually that they may not be able to experience or get a chance to do if they were in the relationship that they're in currently. So non-monogamy is kind of an umbrella term. Polyamory is basically what it looks like when someone has multiple partners and they are in an emotional, romantic, sort of committed relationship with these people.
Okay, so just to clarify, because it sounded like non-monogamy was the function or the method to obtain sexual gratification from multiple partners. And did you distinguish about polyamory by saying it was emotional connection?
Yeah, well, yes and no. So, I mean, the thing that I like to tell people when we're talking about non-monogamy, polyamory, is that it looks different for very, very many different people. So my version of polyamory, which is like having many loves, having multiple relationships that are romantic and emotional, may look different from the person who has polyamory over there and is practicing polyamory over there. It's a really, really personal thing. But by definition, polyamory means many loves. It means that you have multiple relationships in a romantic and emotional capacity. And non-monogamy is more of an umbrella term that can look like basically an umbrella term that polyamory kind of sits under. And so there are some versions of non-monogamy in particular, like mine, where there are emotional and romantic elements within that. I personally don't call myself someone who practices polyamory just because I don't really feel like that resonates with me all that much. I mean, just thinking about the relationships that I've had over the last 7 years, they haven't looked like many loves where we are in an emotional and romantic relationship. It just has never gotten to that point. So I prefer the term non-monogamy to describe me, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm not engaging in emotional intimacy or romantic displays of affection with the partners that I have. Hmm.
Okay. So that brings up an interesting, I guess, question. So in a Christian context, there's some Christians, many Christians, especially in America, that would identify themselves as Trinitarian, meaning they believe in God represented in three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Now, we've discussed previously on the show about why you may or may not gender spirits. But those same persons do acknowledge that God is love, and they mean that all love finds its root in God. Love is a good thing. All good things come from God. Love is one of those things because the nature of God is love. Those same people break out love into three components. Now, they don't limit it to three, but they emphasize three. And those three are the Greek philia, which is where we get our brotherly love, or city of Philadelphia. They also have agape, which is our unconditional love. But then they have eros, which is our romantic love. And so the question becomes, okay, if God is love and love finds its root in God and all of this comes from God. So for the Trinitarian who has a relationship amongst God of three persons, it would appear to be, or they would have to answer the question, you know, is God in this, is God modeling this type of relationship? Meaning, you know, there's brotherly love or between the persons, there's agape love between the persons. But what about the eros? Mm. Is that something that's excluded from God? So you're saying God is love by nature, which means all love is there's no love that's excluded from God. So then we deal with the eros. And so I'd like to pose that question to some of our listeners. How do you see that? Do you see that romantic side of love apart from God? I mean, that's the only thing that God does not display. And if so, why not?
Oh, God, no. I mean, I believe that God is love, and love has many, many different forms. And yeah, love is expressed in many different ways. And it would be kind of silly to say that God is love, except for this one part in terms of like romantic and sexual love. Like I just, that yeah, doesn't really make sense to me.
Yeah, it does. It's illogical, right. But I think because the topic is a little, it kind of feels maybe a little sacrilegious. We won't even approach it. But if you're thinking through them, if you're just thinking through it, and all the elements would suggest that this is a part of it like anything else. So, right. I'm curious what some of our listeners think. So I'm sure they can yell at me about that later. Okay. So how would you kind of classify the relationship that you're in now with your husband?
Yeah. So we are both practicing non-monogamy. We like to say that we're in an open relationship, an open marriage. We've been married for going on 11 years, together for going on 12, and we haven't been open throughout that entire time. So we've only been open, I'd say, within like the last 7 years of our relationship, maybe the last eight or so. So our relationship started out as being strictly monogamous. And that was primarily not something that we actively chose. It was something that we saw modeled within the relationships that were around us, the relationships that our parents had, the relationships that our aunts and our uncles had. So for both of us, we didn't think that there was any other option but to have a relationship where you are committed to one person, that you love one person, that you have sex with one person. And so it wasn't until, I guess, historically, pretty recently, when we started to think about the ways that we wanted our relationship to be different. We wanted to change, I guess, like the trajectory of where our relationship was going. And, you know, we'd had a lot of conversations about this, not in the realm of sex and sexuality and love and relationship, but more so like, you know, looking at our parents and thinking back to the mistakes that we watched them make, and wanting to be very intentional about making our marriage and our relationship not make those same mistakes. Like, we were very clear about, like, we don't want it to look like this. We want it to look like that. And so we were very intentional about the relationship that we were building with each other, but it was just in that one area of sex and sexuality and love and relationship that we were like, oh no, we're supposed to be committed to each other for the rest of our lives. We are not allowed to have feelings or to check other people out or to think other people are attractive. And I guess the way that things started to break open was my husband, his name is Jonathan. He came home one day and he told me that he was starting to develop feelings for someone else, and that those feelings were reciprocated. So basically she on the other end was experiencing those emotions as well. And the way that he told me this wasn't in the way of like, hey babe, so just so you know, I have feelings for this woman and we're going to go out now, so I hope you're okay with that. It was more like he was confessing this to me in a way where he was like, I don't know what to do with this information. Like, I have been taught to that I can only have eyes for you. You're my wife. And the fact that I have these feelings, these emotional feelings for someone else is really throwing me for a loop. I don't know what to do with it. And so we spent, I guess, the next week just processing all of that. It was the first time I ever heard the word polyamory. Before that, I'd never known what it was. I'll be very frank with you and say that when I first heard the word polyamory, I was like, oh, this is some white people shit. Like, this is not something that black people do. Like, I don't do that. For the record, my husband is white and I'm black. So I was looking at him sideways like, oh, well, of course, this is something that would come out of your mouth because like black people don't do this. And so, you know, basically what ended up happening was he said to me that, you know, this is a part of him that he feels very connected to. It's a part of him that he would like to explore, but it's not non-negotiable. So basically what he told me was like, look, I'm cool being in a relationship with you. Like, I don't need to have relationships with other people. I'm very satisfied. And especially because I was like, oh no, there's no way, there's absolutely no way that I'm going to be non-monogamous, polyamorous. Like, that's just not what I do. He was very open to the fact of just leaving it there and being like, cool, so let's continue to be monogamous. And then fast forward a few months to a year, that's when I started to realize that like my own queer identity couldn't be denied anymore. It was something that wanted to be expressed. It was something that I wanted to explore. And so that's when we put non-monogamy back on the table, because as I was exploring my queer identity, I realized that it's going to be impossible for me to do that while I'm married to a man. So that's when we began to really think about non-monogamy and alternative relationships as a viable option for the way that we both wanted our relationship to look like.
So it sounded like in like your level of understanding was bolstered by your discovery or defining of your own sexual identity. So do you think that non-monogamy would have been the path that you chosen had that not happened? So let's say you didn't identify as queer. Let's say you wouldn't have that catalyst to get you thinking or open to other ideas. Do you see that would have happened the same?
So that's a really hard question for me to answer, because like, I can't imagine myself as a straight person because I've never been straight. But what I will say is that I even when I was in the throes of like, I could never do this, there were aspects of non-monogamy and open relationships that really made me curious. You know, I mean, even if I wasn't open to dating other people or open to, you know, dating other men, there were aspects of non-monogamy and just the ways that it was challenging my own norms and my own understandings of what love, fidelity, sex, relationships look like. And also, I think because of the work that I do, I mean, it's something that I talk about a lot in my work, both with my clients and then just, you know, personally. I don't know if I would have always been monogamous. I think that because of the person that I am and because of the ways that me and my husband were continually trying to, you know, squash these norms and build new foundations, and not repeat the same mistakes that our parents did, I think if it would have been in the cards eventually, no matter if I was straight, no matter if I was with him or someone else. I think just the philosophy, the ethos of non-monogamy, it just makes sense to me.
Okay. So I'm trying to anticipate some of our listener questions and be the proxy for some of those questions. So, and I don't want to get too deep into this, but I still have to ask. Okay. So he comes home, he says, you know, he's confessing that he's having these feelings, for another person and it's reciprocated. Who initiates the cussing? Like, is that a thing? Like, is that a situation where it's like, oh, okay.
No. I was pissed. I was heated. And during that time, and I kind of blew through all of that when I was telling the story, because I didn't want to harp on it too long. I don't want to take up too much time with this long drawn out story, but I was pissed. And during that time, the divorce or the word divorce was coming up a lot, because for me, And it wasn't because I was angry at him. I mean, I was partially angry at him, but then when I was able to like dial that back and realize, okay, where is this anger coming from? It was mostly just like frustration that like I figured this out now after we had been together for like 3+ years. And my thing was, look, I'm a huge proponent of people being and living their truth. And the one thing that I told him was like, the only reason why I'm considering divorcing you is because I want you to live the full spectrum of your truth. And if your truth is polyamory, if your truth is having many loves and dating and having emotional romantic connections with other people, that's fine. I don't judge you for that. I don't blame you for that. It's not my ministry. Like, that's not what I want to do at the time. That's what I was saying. But I don't blame you for having these feelings. I don't blame you for having these curiosities because I respect the individual that you are. And so it was only when he was telling me like, no, this is not non-negotiable. Like, I can live my whole life being with just you and I would be completely satisfied, that the D word kind of came off the table and we started thinking about like, okay, so let's go back to our regular monogamous lives then. But yeah, it took me a little while to get over that. I was also pretty angry at the other woman. I'll be very honest and say that because, you know, she was married too. And my whole understanding is like, you know, you knew he was married. Like, you didn't have to, you didn't have to convey your feelings to him and stuff like that. But I mean, again, I mean, my feelings have since changed now that I understand that just like monogamy or just like non-monogamy isn't for everyone, monogamy isn't for everyone. And so I'm able to be a lot more compassionate and a lot more empathetic to both of them because they were stumbling upon information about themselves that they had didn't really fully process yet, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you've been doing this work now. You have been helping people. What do you see as some of the major challenges with people considering non-monogamy approaching? Like, I don't know I don't even know how to ask that question because this is something that's new.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I jealousy 100% is the thing. And that was the thing that actually kept me from feeling like non-monogamy or polyamory would be an option for me when my husband first told me about it, when he was like, I have feelings for this woman. Like, I would sit there and I would think, okay, how would it feel if he walked in the door and he told me that he just went on this date with this woman? How would that feel for me? And I couldn't take away my anger. I couldn't take away my jealousy. Like, I just felt supremely jealous. I felt incredibly territorial. And so those were things that I had to dismantle and unlearn in my own time. But yeah, jealousy is one of the biggest things that I think keep people from feeling like this is a viable option in their relationship. And I mean, jealousy, you know, I think there are two ways to approach jealousy. One is jealousy can be a really important tool that lets you know that like you really, really care about this person. Like, you have jealousy feelings, not because you're just a jealous person. I mean, I'm sure there are some people out there who are like that, but you're feeling jealous is coming from a place of, I deeply love this person. I deeply respect this person. I don't want to share them with anyone else. And so I think that if you can look at jealousy from this place of like, jealousy is a message, like a messenger for you. It's a way for you to remind yourself that like, oh, that's right. I'm jealous because I care. I'm jealous because I love this person. That can be a really cool way to look at it. The other piece to jealousy that I've learned since I've been practicing this is that jealousy isn't a bad thing. I think like, especially when I was thinking about first getting into non-monogamy is, you know, my opinion or my idea was that like, I had to completely release jealousy. Like, I had to like, come to a new state of enlightenment where jealousy would never, ever, ever be an issue. And if by chance I started to feel jealousy come up in my relationship, that means that like I was a bad polyamorous or non-monogamous person. Jealousy is going to happen. I mean, we have been taught for like hundreds and hundreds of years that monogamy is the model, that commitment between one person and the other person is like, you know, the way that things should be. And so I don't necessarily think that jealousy is a marker of a bad person. I don't necessarily think that jealousy is a marker of someone who is underdeveloped. I think it's more so brought on by our culture. Our culture has taught us to be jealous. Our culture has taught us to be possessive and territorial over our partners. And so once you kind of see it from that lens, you can kind of like give yourself a little bit of a break and say like, okay, jealousy is going to happen. So what instead is my new response to it? And that's kind of the way that we work it out in our relationship. Like rather than being like, I'm jealous, that means that you can't go on this date tonight. It's like, okay, I'm jealous. Where is that jealousy coming from? What is behind the jealousy? Usually it's fear. Usually it's fear of abandonment. And so there have been times when I will see my partner going on a date and I'll feel those feelings of jealousy come up. And rather than me, you know, slamming the kitchen door and being passive aggressive, I say to him, I feel jealous. And I realize that it's because I'm afraid that I will lose you, that you will fall in love with this person, that you will choose this person, and that I will be left in the dust. And that's a really important time for your partner and for my partner to do, you know, to give me affirmation, to console me, to be like, no, actually I would never leave you. You are the love of my life. And so like being able to work with jealousy and use it as a teacher and a tool for you to like unpack and like dismantle these ideas about, you know, possession and ownership and things like that. That's been one of the most powerful tools that I've learned, doing non-monogamy.
Wow. That is a interesting and refreshing way to look at jealousy. I mean, to use it one as a gauge for your own feelings, but then two, as kind of a marker to know how to move from that point. I mean,
you know, there's something that you said too earlier that I just want to just like tack on, which is you mentioned that monogamy is like the ruler of the land. And I had this moment in my brain where I was like, actually, that's not true because people be cheating. Like a lot of people are cheating on each other. So I actually wouldn't say that monogamy is the standard because there are a lot of folks who are doing unethical non-monogamy constantly, you know? So, and that's what makes me think so much more about non-monogamy as being perhaps a different kind of default because we're already seeing people who are getting divorces because someone was unfaithful. We're already seeing people who have trouble being in committed relationships because they like dating multiple partners. So what if like we're not broken? What if the system is broken? And if you think about it in that way, it's like, oh, so that means that I get to choose what kind of relationships I get to have with people. And I can do it in a way that is ethical, that is considerate of other people's emotions, and that really suits me and suits my needs. So yeah, I just wanted to mention that because like, I think it's really easy for us to be like, non-monogamy is like the underground way to be in relationships. But in reality, like if we're going to be really technical, most people are non-monogamous because people are constantly cheating, you know?
Yeah. If you listen to your music, the music tells you what's going on.
Right.
Like I remember when I first discovered, like I'm a little bit older and my mom used to listen to Whitney Houston, Saving All My Love For You. I was like, wait a minute. When I got older, I was like, oh, wow, she's on the outside of this relationship that she wants to be in. And, you know, Babyface and Pebbles Love make things happen. Both of them were married in that relationship. And it's just like people have been telling that story.
Yeah, I'm even thinking of the song. I can't remember what it's called, but it's like Secret Lover.
Secret Lover.
Yes. My parents used to sing that song all the time in my house. My Christian parents used to sing this song all the time. So yes, it's very much entrenched in our culture, you know, as easy it is for us to be like, monogamy is the best way to be in relationships. We're all having affairs with everybody else. So is that actually true? And I don't think so.
Well, I think your story is particularly interesting because you transitioned from the monogamous relationship to the non-monogamous relationship. Yeah. And that's not, I mean, that's, I want to ask you so many more questions about that, but
what I will say is,
I don't want to get into
this. I'm an open book. I talk about this all the time. I've talked about this on my podcast. So I'm an open book. I'm so happy to be a resource. If you have any questions, I'm very open. I will say that the transition from being monogamous to non-monogamous was not an easy one for us because we had to unlearn a lot of things. We had to like completely throw away parts of the foundation that our relationship relationship was built on, and then build new parts of our relationship that suited us better and that made us feel like, okay, this is a lot more sustainable. This is a lot more doable for us.
So what did the families do? Like, how did they receive this?
Ooh, so my intention was not to tell my parents because, you know, they're both Christian, very, very Christian. And I didn't want to make them uncomfortable. And I also just didn't feel like it was their business. I mean, in my mind, I was like, well, you know, if it'll become their business, if, for instance, I have a girlfriend and I want to bring that girlfriend over to meet my parents, like, then that's when I can have this conversation. So I was not really thinking about telling them. But I was being very public and open about this on my website, on my blog, and I was writing about it. And even though my mom and dad swore that they wouldn't read that blog because, you know, it was about sex and sexuality and it made them uncomfortable, they did read the articles that I wrote about my open relationship, and they were not happy. They were not happy at all. We had some really uncomfortable conversations, and even to this day, like, we have uncomfortable conversations about just the logistics of, like, what it's like for us to be in a non-monogamous relationship. And with my parents, you know, I'm just like you, or just like with you, I'm an open book. So I am very, very happy and willing to answer any questions that my mom might have about the relationship that I'm in. Actually, one of the most interesting questions that I got from her recently that I still haven't tackled to this day, because I'm like, oh Lord, this is a can of worms I do not want to open right now, was she was like, so, do you have an OkCupid account? And I was like, oh my God. And it was at the tail end of a really long conversation. And I was like, oh my God, this is not the time for us to talk about that. And I basically told her, like, look, I'm so open. I'm so happy to share that information with you when the time is right. But the timing is just not on for me right now. So yeah, I'm very open to discuss it with my family if they have questions, if they have concerns. But then of course, you know, I have to find boundaries, because I also don't want for them to impress upon me their fears and their phobias about the kind of lifestyle that I'm living.
Okay. So there are two questions I need to ask you before I let you go. One, in your work with people coming from different backgrounds, you said previously that you had disconnected from your spiritual upbringing, mm-hmm. faith traditions. Do you find that that is the normal mode? Meaning, are people able to practice non-monogamy and still have a safe space to practice their faith?
I think so. You know, I'll be honest and say that I don't know a lot of Christian non-monogamous polyamory people, but that has nothing to do with them not being around. That has nothing to do with them not existing. I know that they exist. It's just in my circle, in my community, I don't see those types of people. But yeah, I definitely think that it's possible, just in the same way that it's possible for people to be Christian and gay. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's kind of in the same space. And I have so much respect for people who are able to live the lives that they want to live, have the lifestyles that they want to have, and also reconcile with the fact that, like, they have these systems of beliefs and a certain type of faith that may kind of fly in the face of that. I think it's really courageous whenever I see people who are able to hold both of those things in their hands.
Okay. So, yeah, because the doctrines of Christianity represent a strong pull. And then once you add in a doctrine around hell, that becomes a black hole for pulling people in a direction. Mm. And so we've discussed that previously on the show of why that is not a real thing. But I do understand why that influence is very strong, because who wants, for someone who believes in that, who wants to risk that for, you know, for whatever the pleasure or the opportunity is at that time? And I do understand why that's a strong pull, but it's also interesting to me that the book that we as Christians read from didn't seem to be a problem in much of the book. So
that's true.
So your podcast, The Sexually Liberated Woman, which I'm very glad you're back, because I learned a lot.
Thank you.
I love that you do this. How do you see polyamory benefiting you or women specifically? Because we talked at the head of the show about, you know, men were getting all the benefits of this.
Right.
But as a woman, how do you view those benefits?
Well, I'm a human too. And I have human needs, and I have human desires that my partner cannot give to me. And I think that non-monogamy is an option for folks who want to explore a different type of relationship with other people. And the truth is that, you know, a lot of us are practicing polyamory. We just don't have that term for it. We don't give it that term. Like, you know, if you are someone who has four sisters, you're able to love each of those sisters equally. I mean, maybe you might have a favorite, but like, you're able to designate love and support for those three people. Polyamory is the same concept. It's just not in a platonic sense. Like, you know, you would like a parent who has two children who is able to like love both of those children equally. It's the same way. So for women especially, I think it's an important part of just reclaiming their ability to choose, their power to be able to say, I am a sexual being and I have sexual needs. And the reality is that my sexual needs can't always be met, or my emotional needs or my romantic needs can't always be met with the person that I'm with. And I will say that, like, beyond being able to explore and express my queer identity, polyamory, non-monogamy has really allowed me to be more in my power, to like actually create systems and communities and boundaries that fit really well with me and that support me, that support the relationship that I'm in. So I personally feel much stronger of a woman practicing non-monogamy because I know who I am. I know who I am. I know what I want. And I have no qualms about giving myself permission to have those things.
I could listen to you speak about all that. And so anyone who wants to listen to more of Evian Whitney, her podcast is up, The Sexually Liberated Woman. And where else can they find you?
They can find me on my website, sexloveliberation.com. And then, of course, on Instagram, if they want to see me taking sexy selfies, if that's their thing.
Well, again, thank you so much for joining us for this conversation. Yeah. I'm sorry we didn't have a whole team here, but I really appreciated this conversation.
No, this was great. Thank you so much for facilitating it and just for your podcast, like educating folks out there. Like it's really important. I'm glad that you're doing this work.
All right, y'all. Check her out all over the internet. Evian Whitney, EV'YAN, Whitney. For Faith Uncut, I am Mike. We will see you next time.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.